Voilà, merci beaucoup. Nous allons avoir une matinée tout à fait intéressante. Nous avons, je vous le rappelle brièvement, vu hier quelques personnalités bien trempées des débuts de la Croix-Rouge. J'ai beaucoup aimé l'expression les guerriers de l'humanitaire. C'était tout à fait intéressant. Des gens comme Louis Appia, Frédéric Ferrière, John Furley ou encore Henri von Holzbeck. Et nous allons sans doute encore rencontrer quelques-unes de ces belles personnalités aujourd'hui. Nous avons aussi pu constater hier toute l'importance qu'il y avait à bien définir la notion de neutralité qui n'était pas comprise de la même manière, manifestement, par tous les membres de la Croix-Rouge et par les différentes Croix-Rouges nationales, surtout dans les conflits intérieurs ou les conflits guerres civiles. Aujourd'hui, nous allons voyager. Nous allons même à plusieurs reprises traverser l'océan pour mieux comprendre les attitudes que les diverses Croix-Rouges nationales ont pu prendre lors de conflits hors de l'Europe ou aux confins de l'Europe. Alors tout d'abord, je dois déplorer l'absence de l'un de nos conférenciers, M. Philippe Binder, à qui bien sûr nous souhaitons un très prompt rétablissement. Il va nous manquer doublement aujourd'hui puisqu'il devait s'exprimer ce matin sur la mission médicale de la Croix-Rouge suisse lors de la guerre des bourgs, un sujet assez peu connu, et cet après-midi sur les médecins et ambulances de la Croix-Rouge suisse lors des guerres balkaniques. Mais nous aurons sans doute le plaisir de le lire dans les actes qui seront tirés de ces journées. Alors, sans plus attendre, permettez-moi d'accueillir tout d'abord... Alors, je vous explique juste, il y a eu quelques petits changements dans l'ordre de passage. Nous allons accueillir d'abord M. Francisco Javier Martinez Antonio et puis ensuite nous allons écouter Mme Raimonda Ottaviani. Nous ferons alors une petite pause avant de reprendre pour écouter le professeur Vanni et Mme Maria Grazia Bacollo pour revenir ensuite à l'Espagne avec M. Juan Carlos Garcia Reyes et terminer en traversant à nouveau l'océan pour écouter Mme Marianne Moser-Jones. Pour une première fois avant demain. Donc, j'accueille tout de suite Monsieur Francisco Javier Martinez Antonio. Our English speakers guests have received your CV in English, so if you don't mind, I will present you in French for our French speaking audience. D'autant plus que vous travaillez à Paris et que vous parlez tout à fait bien français. Vous êtes notamment chercheur auprès du laboratoire qui porte le joli nom de Sphère. Sciences, philosophie et histoire, une unité de recherche liée à la fois au CNRS et à l'Université de Paris Diderot. Et parmi vos nombreux sujets de recherche, j'ai retenu tout particulièrement un livre que vous avez édité récemment et toutes vos études sur la place et le rôle que l'éducation, la science et tout particulièrement la médecine occupent dans l'action coloniale espagnole au Maroc. Et aujourd'hui, c'est un peu un autre angle que vous allez nous présenter, toujours autour de la Croix-Rouge espagnole, mais une approche un peu plus large, puisque vous allez nous parler de la guerre hispano-américaine de 1898 et aussi de l'insurrection des Philippines qui a suivi entre 1899 et 1902. Donc vous êtes à la croisée des siècles. Et dans ces deux guerres, vous allez analyser plus particulièrement le rôle important qu'a joué la Croix-Rouge américaine et surtout le rôle international, en quelque sorte, qu'elle s'est attribué, un rôle qui jusque-là a été dévolu au Comité international de la Croix-Rouge. C'est donc un moment charnière et nous nous réjouissons de vous entendre à ce sujet.
Bon, merci beaucoup. J'ai changé un peu le titre parce que c'était un travail toujours... provisoire, mais le contenu c'est à peu près la même chose que j'allais raconter. Merci beaucoup pour l'invitation à participer dans cette conférence. Désolé de n'avoir la préparée en français parce que j'avais pensé que les congrès ça serait plutôt en anglais, mais pour les questions et tout ça, si quelqu'un veut me demander en français, pas de problème. I'm starting with some general remarks, preliminary remarks. So I'm really glad to open the session on colonialism, which follows yesterday's European section, because I could have found no better way to highlight an idea which is at the core of all my research. And such idea is the transitional or intermediary character of Spain's position within the international community during the 19th and 20th centuries, which I think is crucial to understand its history, and in particular the history of its Red Cross, as well as the history of international Red Cross in relation to Spanish conflicts. So it makes really good sense, in my opinion, that presentations on Spain are placing the intersection between the national and the colonial sessions. Why? To put it in a rather simple way, in the age of nations and empires, Spain was a second-rate actor. In its metropolitan European nucleus, Spain was ravaged by civil wars, a product of continuing political, social, and territorial tensions. It was left aside from European politics and did not participate in major European wars. In its overseas possessions, a tiny fraction of its once worldwide empire, so uprisings and conflicts were continuous to. And by contrast, Spain only marginally participated in Europe's expansion in Africa and Asia. As a result, in my opinion, analytical concepts like nation-state or colonies are difficult to apply to the Spanish case without modifications. So they let historical realities slip between our fingers like water. Spain seems to be placed in between categories, somewhere in a continuum scale ranging from independent nations to colonized societies. So what I am proposing you today in this presentation is precisely an exploration of intermediary transitional realities in a history of the Red Cross, which is usually framed by discrete national or colonial categories. Such exploration will be done with regard to the particular case of the wars of independence of the last Spanish overseas possessions between 1895 and 98, including the so-called Spanish-American War. Our approach will briefly comment some atypical features of the Spanish Red Cross, but it is especially focused on the American Red Cross. The American Red Cross, by contrast with present-day realities associated with the most powerful state in the world, was still, by the end of the 19th century, a small-sized, problematically organized, and rather atypical Red Cross society, according to international standards. Activities in Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines mark a turning point in the history of the ARC in many aspects, including the beginning of a modern national organization and of a challenge to the existing model of international Red Cross as defined by the Geneva Committee since the early days we are here commemorating. So I will begin with an analysis of the ARC activities in relation with prisoners, because that's the specific area I'm focusing in this presentation. So, in general, Red Cross activities in the conflicts of 95-98 included support to the belligerent armies, assistance to civilians, and prisoner relief. But the latter aspect was especially concentrated in the Spanish-American War of April-July 1898 and its aftermath. So, several Red Cross societies were involved, but the most relevant was the American Red Cross. So, just to be quick, because it's the most well-known aspect, the ARC assisted over 2,000 Spanish civil and military prisoners captured by US naval and military forces. So, you have here, for example, 400 seamen who were taken to Key West in Florida and were assisted by Clara Barton personally, who was there waiting for the American Navy to allow her to go to Cuba. Then there were a small number who were taken to Fort McPherson in Atlanta, and there were this most important contingent of 1,600 Navy officers and sailors who were taken to Portsmouth in New Hampshire, and some officers were taken to Annapolis. So they were assisted by American Red Cross nurses, especially for questions of yellow fever. So that's the most well-known aspect. But ARC activities regarding prisoners did not stop with the end of the war. So the Article 6 of the peace treaty between the USA and Spain, signed in Paris in December 1898, that's a picture of that, the signature of that treaty. This article said that Spain will, upon the signature of the present treaty, release all prisoners of wars, and that's the important, and all persons detained or imprisoned for political offenses in connection with the insurrections in Cuba and the Philippines and the war with the United States. So, as late as April 1901, the Spanish Red Cross received a confidential letter from Clara Barton, in which Barton explained that the ARC had been presented a complaint from an American citizen that affirmed that thousands of Cuban political prisoners were still held by the Spanish government in prisons located in its African enclaves of the northern coast of Morocco and the Gulf of Guinea. The complaint was endorsed by the State Department and the US President himself, but none could provide information about its truth or falseness, so Barton decided to ask the Spanish Red Cross. After receiving her letter, the Spanish Red Cross President, Marquis of Polavieja, addressed the Spanish Prime Minister, who in turn made an official request to the Ministries of War, Navy, Justice and Home Office to know if they held any political prisoners. All of them denied it, and the Spanish Red Cross transmitting that information back to Barton. So the Spanish Red Cross and the Spanish government were telling the truth. However, there had been indeed hundreds, this is a copy of the letter sent by the Spanish Red Cross to the Spanish Prime Minister and the Ministry of the Foreign Office. So the Spanish Red Cross and the Spanish government were telling the truth, but there had indeed been hundreds of Cuban, Puerto Rican and Filipino political prisoners in Spanish African penitentiaries in the previous years. So deportation procedures had actually been set up during the first war of Cuban independence in 1868-78. And some such procedure was repeated and enlarged during the conflict of 95-98, with the first group of prisoners being sent to Ceuta as early as October 1895. It is difficult to fix the exact number of people, but there is some primary and secondary sources about these political deportees. So this is more or less an estimation, a conservative estimation, of Cubans, Puerto Ricans and Filipinos sent to the Spanish African penitentiaries. So you have here a map to see the exact location of these African enclaves. So it is also true that a good part of these political prisoners were kept there after the war was over. So shortly after hostilities ended, and before the peace treaty was signed, the US consuls in Madrid, they had begun to press the Spanish authorities so that these prisoners were free. And the Spanish government passed some various decrees of amnesty, and for example, 290 Cubans were released in October 1898. But several kind of prisoners, including the so-called ñáñigos, which were like black people, member of a secret society opposed to Spanish rule, as well as anarchists and convicted of banditry, they were retained until December of that year, so it was like more or less 300 people. From 1900 onwards, the political prisoners were reduced to a minimum. So, despite denunciations such as the one which triggered Clara Barton's request, almost all overseas political prisoners in Spain and Spanish African penitentiaries had been sent back to Cuba, Puerto Rico and the Philippines. And the ones who remained, they had offenses which had no connection with the war, so their conviction had usually started before 1895 for criminal offenses. So this is a provisional record also of the people kept between 1899 and 1906. In the Philippines, by contrast, the American Red Cross intervened especially in favor of the release of Spanish prisoners, actually of Spanish and US prisoners in the hands of insurgents, especially of Emilio Aguinaldo, who was the main leader in the Filipino uprising. So, as the Filipinos refused to accept US permanent occupation of the country, an anti-American revolution started on February 1899. So, as a result, Spanish prisoners who had been kept by thousands all over the archipelago were caught in the middle of a new armed conflict. So, according to recent studies, there were about 13,000 Spanish prisoners all over the Philippines, including soldiers, civilians, and priests. So, the American Red Cross soon became actively involved in the release of Spanish prisoners in the Philippines. As a result of Spanish demands, the Spanish Red Cross addressed Clara Barton as early as September 1898. So, the Vice President of the Spanish Red Cross sent the following telegram to the American Red Cross. Inspired only sentiments, charity, humanity, Spanish Red Cross begs you intercede government, influence Aguinaldo, liberate immediately prisoners without distinction, age, class, or sex. So Barton passed this telegram to the State Department, who sent it to the War Department, which sent it to General Otis, who was the commander of American forces in Manila. So Otis demanded Aguinaldo the liberation of prisoners, but the latter refused on two occasions in October 1898. 1 month later, Aguinaldo issued a decree with his demands for proceeding to the liberation of Spanish prisoners. And he asked that Spain should first release Spanish Filipino prisoners kept in Spain as well as in other Pacific islands who were in possession of Spain, such as the Carolinas and the Marianas. So, a Spanish priest would be excluded from this scheme because they only would be freed after direct negotiations were established with the Pope. But nothing was done about this. So, in January 1899, the Spanish government demanded US President William McKinley that steps were taken to secure the release of Spanish prisoners, because it was argued was an obligation also in the Article 6 of the Paris Peace Treaty, which continued saying, reciprocally, the United States will release all persons made prisoners of war by the American forces and will undertake to obtain the release of all Spanish prisoners in the hands of the insurgents in Cuba and the Philippines. So, if the US did not comply with this obligation, the Spanish government was decided to take its own initiatives, meaning that it would negotiate the payment of a ransom to the insurgents. US-Filipino contacts led, however, to the Filipinos liberating all Spanish military and civil sick prisoners at the end of January. So, about 9,000 still remain captive. At the end of February, the Spanish government decided the liberation of Filipinos held in Spain and Spanish African penitentiaries. General Rios, head of the remaining Spanish military forces in the Philippines, was then authorized by the Spanish government to negotiate with Aguinaldo the payment of a ransom. But the US, and especially General Otis, opposed to this. So, to try and block this initiative, the Spanish Red Cross asked again Clara Barton in March 1899 to address the US government to tell General Otis to allow these contacts. So Barton sent a letter to the War Department saying that the people of Spain, and I quote, are very much alarmed over the fate of Spanish prisoners held by those who are under no treaty obligations with respect to the treatment of prisoners of war. So this is the letter that's kept in the National Archives in Washington. So the War Department ordered General Otis to allow these negotiations, but General Otis refused. So the Spaniards, they tried several attempts at negotiating between March and October 1899. But General Otis feared that the money would be used by Aguinaldo to buy weapons and continue the fight, While obtaining from the Spanish government the so much desired official recognition to his self-appointed Filipino Republic. Spanish prisoners would only be released after American military operations in late November 1899. So in early December they began to be repatriated to Spain together with the remaining Spanish army units until April 1900. So about 17,000 people were taken back to Spain. On December the 13th, the Spanish Red Cross sent the following telegram to Barton. "The Assembly, the Spanish Assembly, profoundly recognized with infinite thanks your work and that of the generous American government in the liberation of Spanish prisoners." So I move to the following point. François Bunyan has affirmed in his book Le Comité International de la Croix Rouge et la Protection des Victimes de la Guerre that the intervention of the American Red Cross in favor of Cuban civilians in the early months of 1898 was a significant precedent in the history of the Red Cross, in the sense that, and I quote, "It was the first time that a national society foreign to a country affected by a civil war got permission to act in the side of the insurrection." So I would like to argue that the activities regarding prisoners that I have commented were just another aspect of this atypical involvement of the American Red Cross. So the assistance to Spanish prisoners of war could have been seen as conventional if we only forgot that the US was intervening in an internal conflict of another country without any kind of international consent. That's for prisoners of war. Regarding Cuban and Puerto Rican political prisoners in Spain and Spanish African penitentiaries, the US government and the American Red Cross acted as if those prisoners were actually American citizens, whose interests they will be entitled to represent and defend. In the case of Spanish prisoners in the Philippines, the American Red Cross was directly involved in the rescue, even if the US Army refused to follow its suggestions. So all these activities, they share a common feature. The American Red Cross acted in Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines as if it acted in US territory. Was this attitude only an effect of the war? I don't think so. I believe that during and after the war, the US purely advanced on a course of action set up since the end of the First Cuban War of Independence. In my opinion, that war turned the Cuban question into an openly trilateral affair. And this affair was now moved more by nationalist than colonialist goals, either for Spaniards, for Cubans, and for Americans. In my opinion, Spain and the USA had then begun, after the War of 68-78, a competition for nationalizing Cuba, that is, for achieving the straight integration of the island in their own nation states and political systems. So Spanish growing weakness as a nation state led it to consider Cuba as a last desperate element for achieving national cohesion, even if this would have meant creating a highly unmanageable and heterogeneous transatlantic state-nation. The US, on the other hand, saw in Cuba one of its last opportunities for prolonging the policy of manifest destiny responsible for the acquisition of its huge territory during the 19th century, and whose last successes had been the incorporations of Alaska in 1867 and Hawaii in 1898. Finally, the Cubans sought to gain either autonomy or national independence against both Spain and the US. So the radical incompatibility between all these projects would explain the new and harsh conflict that began in 1895. So in my opinion, the period between 78 and 95 so the Spanish authorities, which still retain sovereignty over Cuba, tacitly consent to growing US intervention in all spheres for avoiding open conflict with the Americans. So this would explain the peculiar form taken by Recto's activities in Cuba when conflict broke out in 1895. So on the one hand, the Spanish Red Cross took advantage of the insurrection for seriously displaying itself in the island, in Cuba and also in the Philippines. So given that Spain had been trying to nationalize Cuba, since the end of the First War of Independence, it is logical that the Spanish Red Cross extended its organization and activities as it was just another Spanish province. So a Junta Central was established in Havana in the spring of 1895, the first step of a network that would extend to main localities. Activities focused on assisting army officers and soldiers and ranged from the establishment of hospitals and kitchens to giving money and clothes to sick soldiers sent back to Spain. Cuban patriots strongly criticized the inhumanity of the Spanish Red Cross, which refused to assist either wounded insurgent soldiers or civilian reconcentrados. We'll talk about this now. In the immediate aftermath of the war, the Spanish Red Cross participated in the massive repatriation of the Spanish army, with tens of thousands of wounded and sick arriving at Red Cross hospitals, which had been provisionally established throughout Spain during the previous years of the war. So, in the case of the American Red Cross, its involvement in Cuba prior to the US declaration of war in April 1898 was also a continuation of previous nationalist projects or aspirations. So instead of providing aid or funds for the Spanish Red Cross and or the insurgents, the American Red Cross directly displayed on the ground for taking care of Cuban civilians. By focusing on civilians, the American Red Cross followed the idiosyncratic feature which differentiated it from most existing Red Cross societies, as Marian Mosson-Jones has explained in her book The American Red Cross from Clara Barton to the New Deal. So she will surely explain it in her forthcoming presentation. So the ARC intervened in favor of the so-called reconcentrados, that is, civilians who had been obliged to leave the countryside by Spanish military authorities for depriving the insurgents of local support and manpower. So hundreds of thousands of them had been forced to settle down in concentration camps located in the vicinity of the main towns, suffering from inadequate housing, lack of food, non-potable water, and insufficient clothing, and therefore being ravaged by disease and malnutrition. Press campaigns, political debates, and demands from US pro-Cuban groups, such as the Cuban American League, made President McKinley ask for and obtain from Spanish authorities permission to intervene in favor of reconcentrados on the 24th of December, 1897. So a so-called Central Cuban Relief Committee was set up in New York, in which the American Red Cross took seat. So after sending the first cargoes of clothes, food and medicines to the island, Barton herself traveled to Havana with 20 voluntaries in a full loaded ship in early February 1898. Food was distributed, aid provided to hospitals and an orphanage opened. And Barton stayed in Cuba until the US declaration of war obliged her to leave the island. So during these 2.5 months she entertained cordial relations with Spanish authorities. On the contrary, Cuban patriots criticized the American Red Cross, saying that it was helping Spain to solve a rear guard problem and therefore easing its war effort. So the American Red Cross also took care of Cuban civilian refugees who had started fleeing the island since the outbreak of the war. Thus, several thousands of Cuban refugees had arrived with their hands empty at Key West and Tampa in Florida, at least since 1896. To assist them, committees and agents of the ARC were established in both localities, which served as distributing agencies of the supplies sent by the American Red Cross first and the Cuban Relief Committee later. So for example, in Key West, up to 1,700 people were fed daily by the ARC kitchen. And as we commented before, 400 Spanish civil prisoners in Key West were also fed by the American Red Cross. So both the Spanish and American Red Cross extended the organization to Cuba as if it were their own national territory. Coexistence was possible because of the agreement between both governments and because each Red Cross focused on tangential sectors of the population. But that situation would only last until the US declared war on Spain. But after US victory, the American Red Cross just continued with this scheme, only without competition and in a larger scale. So the road was now open for integrating Cuba in the American Red Cross. And to see that it was no exceptional thing, we should remember that this organization was still quite inarticulated at the national level by the end of the century. So Barton, for example, had been unsuccessfully asking for a federal charter since 1882. And therefore, the American Red Cross was a very small organization. And moreover, although the American Red Cross was supposed to centralize all Red Cross activities throughout the country, its influence and structure did not actually reach too many places in the country. So for example, the New York Red Cross Committee enjoyed considerable autonomy and had much more resources than the Washington Central Office. A California Red Cross was organized independently in 1898 in that state and was responsible for early relief in the Philippines without the American Red Cross knowing about this. And many US states and localities that lacked a Red Cross chapter or branch. So only after the Spanish-American War helped the ARC to being granted a federal charter in 1900 and later in 1905, a serious process of centralization and territorial organization began. But the ARC would now try to include ex-Spanish territories in this organization, as if it were US states. So for example, in the Philippines, after these first activities of the California Red Cross, the American Red Cross sent a delegate to establish an emergency hospital in Manila. And in 1905, that was in September 1899, and in 1905, the Philippine branch of the American Red Cross was organized with the presence of Barton's substitute, Mabel T. Borman, and the ex-governor of the Philippines, Secretary of War and future US President William H. Taft. So this Philippine branch became the 15th of the American Red Cross, an early bird in advance of many US states, and would remain an integral part of the American Red Cross until the Japanese occupation of the Philippines in 1942. Puerto Rico's branch was organized shortly after the war ended, and a chapter was created in 1917, which is still a part of the American Red Cross organization. In the case of Cuba, there were several initiatives in parallel, both by Cuban patriots and by American Red Cross. So in the case of the American Red Cross, a so-called, and I quote, Cuban Red Cross auxiliary to the American National was created in Tampa, probably in connection with this relief to refugees in 1896. And after the war ended, Barton herself initiated the process that led to the creation of the so-called Cuban branch of the American Red Cross. This branch, it assumed most local initiatives when Barton left the island for good in September 1899. The end of the US first occupation of Cuba in 1902 did not prevent the Cuban branch to continue to be linked to the American Red Cross. So an independent Cuban Red Cross was not created until the end of the second US military occupation in 1909. Here you have some documents of relief provided by the American Red Cross to Cuban refugees in Tampa. So the last point after this challenge, in my opinion, of the American Red Cross to a colonial organization, there was also a challenge to the hegemony of the Geneva Committee. Although the American Red Cross was a small society and quite marginal at the end of the 19th century in the Red Cross world, it had a great potential to expand either territorially or numerically. Its activities within the US, plus relief provided in places so far from one another as Russia, Armenia, Cuba and the Philippines, proved this. But this potential would gradually become a menace for the ICRC, for various reasons. A very important one was that a strengthened American society would be capable of promoting a tradition of aid to civilians in natural disasters, epidemics, or distress, different from the usual support to military medical services promoted by the Geneva Committee. Secondly, the American Red Cross could also rely on increasingly powerful US diplomatic networks and commercial interests throughout the world. And finally, the American society, due to its geographical location, cultural background, and historical tradition, felt less dependent from the ICRC and promoted more horizontal relations with other Red Cross societies. The creation of the League of Red Cross Societies in 1919 was the final expression of this challenge posed by Washington to Geneva. However, it has not been sufficiently stressed, in my opinion, that the 1895-98 conflicts were seminal examples of these challenges of the American Red Cross, of its potential for, and I quote, making international humanitarianism American, as Julia Irwin has expressed in her book, Making the World Safe, the American Red Cross and the Nation's Humanitarian Awakening. So I will comment like two aspects of the same question. So on the one hand, the weak involvement of the ICRC in the conflicts of 95-98, and second, the innovative action promoted by the American Red Cross in these conflicts. So among the initiatives of the Geneva Committee, we must highlight that the Swiss government, that the Geneva Committee pressed by way of the Swiss government managed that US and Spain agreed to put in practice the additional articles of the Geneva Conference of 1868 regarding naval wars. So that was immediately applied. It was agreed on May the 9th, so just days after the conflict started, or weeks. More specifically, the Geneva Committee addressed the Spanish and American Red Cross on the very day of the declaration of war to inform them that it would raise funds from other Red Cross societies to be sent to them, as it had been done in previous international conflicts. So the Spanish Red Cross replied 4 days later, expressing its thanks but refusing aids on the grounds that their medical preparations for war were enough. If they needed aid later, they would request the Geneva Committee. The Americans did not reply until the 8th of June, so that's more 1.5 months later. In any case, the American Red Cross agreed to this initiative of the Geneva Committee, and making an appeal for funds in favor of its activities in the war. However, for technical difficulties, the ICRC did not launch this appel en faveur de la cause américaine until the 20th of June. So that's 2 weeks later than the US Marines had already started operations in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. As we will comment later, a number of Red Cross societies had already, and by their own impulse, sent their funds to the American Red Cross directly, so without waiting to this committee's appeal. Finally, the ICRC played some minor role in the Philippines after the war. As I've said, the Filipino leader Aguinaldo was seeking for international recognition for his republic, so he tried direct negotiations with Spain or the US or the United States on the question of prisoners. But there were also alternative ways for achieving these recognitions. So for example, in August 1900, Felipe Agoncillo, a diplomatic representative of the Filipino government, addressed the ICRC so that the committee held, and I quote, to conclude an arrangement with the government of the United States with a view to application of the principles of the Convention of Geneva to the struggle which is being prolonged in the islands. End of the quote. So the American Red Cross did not answer, and the request was sent again in October 1900. No answer again, and the request was sent on the 24th January 1901 again. But the American Red Cross just ignored this request. And in March 1901, Aguinaldo was captured by American forces and the Filipino Republic dissolved. So the question was ended. Agoncillo's proposal probably intended obtaining international recognition, intended that the charity organization set up by his wife would be recognized as an independent Filipino Red Cross Society, as this did not take place. So I just finished just with the operations of the American Red Cross. So I think the challenge to the Geneva Committee was in three ways. One, the focus on civilians. Second, involvement in prisoner release. And third, horizontal relations. So focus on civilians, we have seen with the reconcentrados, etc., which was the result of a bilateral agreement between the Spanish and US governments. Prisoners, I have also commented. And horizontal relations. We have, for example, the Portuguese Red Cross played a crucial role because it set up a correspondence service which sent letters to Spanish prisoners in the US and the Philippines. And it was the origin of the correspondence service of the Portuguese Red Cross, which would be subsequently used in the Boer War in 1900. Then the French Red Cross, the Portuguese, and others sent funds to the American Red Cross directly before the ICRC appeal. And also the Canadian branch of the British Society for Aid to the Wounded. And finally, for example, the Imperial Chinese government, by way of its consul in New York, contacted the American Red Cross so that the scheme for relief of Cuban reconcentrados was extended to the Chinese community in Cuba. So just the conclusions. The 1895-98 conflicts would have been crucial steps in the development of the American Red Cross. And it would pose a double challenge, a challenge to the model of colonial expansion of European Red Crosses, on the one hand, and a challenge to the model of international Red Cross as promoted by the ICRC. Thank you.
Merci beaucoup pour ce stimulant exposé. Je vous propose de garder les quelques questions pour juste avant la pause, donc après avoir écouté notre seconde oratrice de la journée. Nous allons cette fois partir en Italie avec Madame Raimonda Ottaviani, médecin de formation mais spécialisée en histoire de la médecine, auteur de nombreux ouvrages sur ce sujet d'histoire de la médecine et également traductrice de la biographie d'Henri Dunant, la petite biographie rédigée par Roger Durand. Et aujourd'hui, c'est sur une personnalité marquante du mouvement de la Croix-Rouge italienne, le chirurgien Bartolomeo Grisoli, pardon pour mon accent, et son rôle durant la première guerre balkanique de 1912-1913, dont vous allez nous parler.
Madame, Monsieur, bonjour à tous. Je remercie vous pour l'accueil en fait, belle ville. Je vais commencer. Mon sujet est sur Bartolomeo Grisoli, chef de chirurgie à la première campagne balkanique. Il naquit à Mezzano, près de Ravenne, le 18 décembre 1858. Son père Charles, issu d'une ancienne famille de Ferrara, avec une généalogie de médecins qui, pendant 5 siècles, avait exercé cette profession, est un pharmacien. Sous l'influence du milieu familial et des traditions, il suit les cours d'études en pharmacie et en 1860, excusez-moi, 18. Il commence à fréquenter la deuxième année de médecine et de chirurgie à l'université de Bologne. Pendant les premières années de son séjour en Bologne, il participe aux événements politiques et fréquente des centres socialistes où il connaît Andrea Costa, un fondateur du Parti socialiste, et Giovanni Pascoli, un poète, mais il ne tarde pas à se passionner pour les études de médecine. En 1883, il obtient le titre de docteur en médecine. Il va fréquenter comme assistant de la clinique de médecine du Grand Murri et de chirurgie de Loretta. Il est avide d'apprendre et se déplace avec courage. Il va à Turin pour aider à soulager les malades de choléra et après se rendi à Castiglione Fiorentino où il a été nommé directeur chirurgical de l'hôpital. Sa Genève, laquelle offre ses services gratuitement aux pauvres, est d'exemple pour le prochain et il gagne l'estime de ses collègues et la confiance des citoyens en raison de ses capacités de diagnostiquer les maladies, sa sensibilité, son intelligence et sa préparation spécifique exceptionnelle. En 1884, à Turin, il connaît le professeur Antonio Carle, un chercheur de Valois qui était allé à l'étranger pour visiter des cliniques et des laboratoires d'avant-garde. Carle, en italien, avait apporté à Turin nouvelles idées, nouvelles techniques et nouveaux modèles d'organisation de la chirurgie. Également, Nirisoli voyage et se documente à l'étranger. En 1886, est à Paris à l'Institut Pasteur. En 1890 est en Allemagne et en 1897 en Angleterre, puis en Russie, en Finlande, en Suède et enfin en Danemark. Il a passé des années totalement consacrées à pratiquer la chirurgie. En 1899, Nigrisoli obtient le professorat de la clinique chirurgien et est appelé par Alfonso Poggi. Il est aide en médecine près l'Université de Bologne. En 1890, il est à Ravenne comme chef de chirurgie de l'hôpital civique. En 1905, Nigrisoli a la nomination de chirurgien en chef de la section chirurgicale primaire de l'hôpital maggiore de Bologne. Il est chirurgien en chef à Bologne pour 10 années. La seule interruption de cette activité fut dans les années 1912 et 1913. Quand, au début de la première campagne balkanique, il part avec la Croix-Rouge italienne pour le Monténégro. La première guerre balkanique commence en octobre 1912, lorsque le royaume du Monténégro déclare la guerre à l'Empire ottoman. Peu de temps après, les règnes de la Bulgarie, de la Serbie, de la Grèce ont adhéré à la guerre. Avec la participation de la Ligue balkanique, les conflits s'attendus dans toute la péninsule. En moins de 2 mois, l'armée ottomane a subi une série de défaites par mer et par terre. Il est dans les mains de la Ligue qui a conquis presque toutes les possessions ottomanes dans les Balkans. En décembre 1912, on aboutit à une trêve, mais les accords diplomatiques pour mettre fin à la guerre, négociés par les puissances européennes, n'avaient aucun résultat positif et ont fait la reprise de l'hostilité en février 1913. Forteresse ottomane d'Adrianople, Scutari et Giannina avait remporté des fêtes par la Ligue. Un second armistice a été signé le 24 avril. Par l'intermédiaire des puissances européennes, le 30 mai 1913, on est venu à le traité de Londres, qui a mis fin au conflit. L'Empire ottoman a perdu presque toutes ses possessions européennes qui ont été réparties entre les États de la Ligue balkanique. Les dissidences pour la partition de la région de la Macédoine, provoquées par ces frictions, mènent à la deuxième guerre balkanique, en juin-juillet 1913. Nigrisoli raconte dans son livre Parva. Nous avons décidé de rester en dehors 3 mois, avec un hôpital de 5 lits, provenant de Bologne, et une ambulance de 20 lits de Turin. Mais dans Podgorica, en février 1913, l'hôpital a compté jusqu'à 700 lits et les 3 mois sont devenus 7. En Podgorica, l'hôpital fut organisé dans l'édifice du monopole des selles du tabac. Bartolo Nigrisoli se montra comme un grand organisateur, chef de chirurgie, médecin et homme de nature humanitaire. Il raconte: notre travail pendant la campagne militaire a été bien apprécié. Chacun de nous, médecins, infirmiers, italiens, sont bien partout et toujours accueillis et aimés. Nos cliniques sont beaucoup fréquentées, bien que le Monténégro ait un beau hôpital moderne à Cetinje. Les Monténégrins, comme tous les Balkans slaves, n'aiment pas l'Italie. La collaboration avec les missions d'autres nations a grandement contribué à notre succès et nous avons eu l'aide amicale très bonne de nos concitoyens du monopole du tabac. Cette présence du chirurgien en chef, professeur Nigrisoli, représentait une excellente assistance et des soins, les meilleurs, pas sans humanité, tant qu'il était consulté par les Russes et les Français aussi. Les professeurs abolit la pratique de reléguer les blessés graves qui ont refusé l'intervention dans un milieu à part. Il a organisé, avec l'aide du personnel médical supplémentaire envoyé par la CRI, une sorte de chaîne de santé de la Croix-Rouge qui va du champ de bataille à Podgorica. Il y a un poste de concentration et est dégagé à Planica. L'hôpital de guerre atteint la capacité de 430 lits. Les blessés traités sont 1687. 74 patients du service de chirurgie, 481 de celui de la médecine, en tout 1240 patients. Le président du comité central général, M. Rinaldo Taverna, a adressé au président de la Croix-Rouge de Bologne, Modoni, les mots suivants. Le professeur Nigrisoli, le directeur, s'est révélé avoir des qualités des plus hauts degrés. Je vous félicite beaucoup et je vous remercie pour avoir moi lui recommandé, parce que devant la tâche difficile, son l'homme supérieur de discernement et son caractère, il n'aurait pas eu rien de bon. C'est la table résumée du professeur Nigrisoli, publiée dans le 31 décembre 1913. Vous pouvez voir les nombres des blessés, des malades et des morts. En tout, 2284 et seulement 19 morts seulement. Il écrit un rapport sur la mission de la Croix-Rouge pendant la campagne du Monténégro contre la Turquie et un livre sur les observations et la pratique de la chirurgie de guerre. Ce livre est un guide pratique illustré bien richement avec 85 photographies de blessures. Il comprend également de nombreuses images radiologiques. Et vous pouvez voir l'avant-page de ce livre. Son expérience de blessures de guerre, de fractures et de la chirurgie vasculaire devient alors précieuse au moment de l'entrée en guerre en 1915. Avant de partir pour la Carnia, lors du déclenchement de la Première Guerre mondiale, il a quitté sa clinique privée à la Croix-Rouge. Il était le chef de la mission chirurgicale de la Croix-Rouge italienne, consultant désigné et inspecteur de la santé des hôpitaux et des services chirurgicaux de santé militaire. En mai 1916, il dirige l'armée d'ambulance chirurgicale, place qu'il occupe jusqu'à la fin du conflit. 3 000 blessés sont assistés par lui. Et enfin, la dignité humaine. En 1924, il a rejeté la proposition pour une place au Sénat parce qu'il ne voulait pas profiter de la popularité acquise pour des fins personnelles. En 1931, il a refusé de signer le serment d'allégeance au fascisme, qui a riposté en l'exonérant de toute position officielle. Di Grisoli écrit: les concepts de la moralité et de la dignité humaine qui m'avaient ouvert la voie à la chaise étaient les mêmes que celui qui m'a fait rejeter, parce que le bon moral est devenu, sous le fascisme, un mal. Merci pour votre attention.
Merci beaucoup pour ce beau portrait qui nous rappelle aussi, en passant, la rudesse des combats de la guerre balkanique, parce que vous avez mentionné 2240 blessés entre 12 et 13, et 3000 pour l'ambulance pendant toute la Première Guerre mondiale. Donc, ça montre aussi à quel point cette guerre balkanique, ces deux guerres balkaniques ont été épouvantables, tragiques, enfin vraiment des pages sombres. Oui, et seulement dans son ambulance, c'est vraiment assez affolant comme chiffre. Alors, j'ouvre la discussion, les questions vont sans doute pas manquer, nous avons des approches assez différentes, mais qui finalement montrent tout le rôle politique que peuvent remplir les Croix-Rouges, américaines d'un côté, et puis les tensions qui peuvent se jouer aussi, hein, notamment lorsqu'il dit que les Italiens sont assez mal vus au Monténégro, mais que par la Croix-Rouge, on peut peut-être montrer une autre image du pays. C'est tout à fait intéressant. Donc, je cède volontiers la parole à qui souhaite poser une question à l'un ou l'autre de nos conférenciers.
Peut-être une question plutôt informative à Mme Ottaviani. Merci d'abord pour votre exposé, mais disons, la Croix-Rouge de Belgique a aussi envoyé donc 4 missions pendant les deux guerres balkaniques. Et là, quand je lis les rapports du médecin principal, le docteur de Page, il dit que c'est surtout, c'était tout à fait nouveau à ce moment-là. Donc, on donnait du soin, les ambulances étaient situées vraiment tout près des lieux de bataille. Et que c'était un conseil, à ce moment-là, pour lui, tout à fait nouveau. Parce qu'avant, un des grands problèmes était que souvent, il y avait une très grande distance entre les blessés sur le terrain, disons, et les hôpitaux. Et que pour lui, c'était un concept nouveau que lui a pratiqué après, pendant la Première Guerre mondiale, dans les hôpitaux en Belgique. Et que, disons que ce concept n'était pas tout à fait accepté par les militaires, et parce qu'ils trouvaient ça trop dangereux. Est-ce que dans les écritures du docteur Nicolosoli, ou dans les rapports, vous avez lu ce même constatation, ces mêmes discussions.
Seulement un résumé de mon article qui sera publié avec beaucoup de détails dans la biographie et dans la guerre balkanique. Parce que je ne parle bien le français et alors ne voulais pas prendre trop attention, trop temps. Et alors j'ai fait un résumé. Mais vous pouvez lire l'article qui est plus riche des détails.
À les hôpitaux, c'est le même problème. Les distances sont terribles.
Mais le professeur a bien résolu ce problème de distance. Avec sa organisation. Il avait plus d'hôpital, beaucoup d'hôpital. Et dans la table qu'il fait voir, il a tous les lieux où le blessé pouvait être porté. Et bien détaillé.
Je remercie Madame Ottaviani de nous avoir présenté cet exposé très intéressant sur une personnalité que nous connaissions mal à Genève. Des photos que nous avons vues, j'ai eu l'impression qu'il pratiquait aussi de la chirurgie réparatrice. On a vu le front d'un blessé juste guéri, mais encore terriblement marqué, et je crois qu'on a vu la même personne après avec un front réparé. Est-ce que c'est le début de la chirurgie réparatrice de guerre? Est-ce que vous pouvez nous dire quelque chose sur cet aspect?
Non, mais la photo que j'ai fait voir, une blessure en voie de guérison, mais n'est pas. Et seulement sur la tête. Et cette photo est dans les livres que j'ai fait voir. Et n'est pas sinusite. Elle n'est pas. Ah, réparatrice. Réparatrice? Oui, oui. Réparatrice.
Non, excusez. La chirurgie réparatrice devient un important pas de la chirurgie à l'initie des.
Non, 900. Esthétique, voulez-vous. Esthétique, ah, esthétique.
Et non, non, et pas esthétique. Non, réparatrice.
Non.
Réparatrice. Il ne parle pas d'esthétisme.
Non.
Ok.
Non, mais la chirurgie esthétique, elle est à la première, à l'année. Commencer alors, juste alors.
Merci. This is my question is for Paco Martinez. If I have not understood. I have seen that the activities of the Red Cross, both in the American and the Spanish, concerning the colonial conflicts in the Caribbean and in Philippines, were focused mostly on prisoners, and that the Red Cross national sections, both in Spain and in the United States, were quite remarkably aligned and with the political positions and national interests or their respective countries. Is this right, or you can see any way in which any leader in the Spanish Red Cross or in the American Red Cross try to develop their own policies irrespectively of the national concerns of and imperial concerns of both countries?
Well, to speak of the American Red Cross, I think there were quite a lot of tensions between the Clara Barton and the American military and the American government. especially with the American military. So the U.S. Army did not really appreciate too much the services of the American Red Cross for the military operations. So, for example, when she goes with a ship to Cuba to aid civilians in after the declaration of war, she's just stopped by the Admiral Sampson, the head of the U.S. Navy, and she has to stay in Key West, so she cannot go there. Afterwards, when she tries to help the U.S. military operating in the Santiago de Cuba and Guantanamo, etc., the chief, the head of the U.S. Army Military Medical Service, which was Stenberg, Major Stenberg, he doesn't appreciate too much the services of the American Red Cross. That, I think, that does not mean that it's a collaboration, but again, when the war is over, I think the American Red Cross goes back to this main interest, which were the civilians and the prisoners. So even if we have these tensions, I think the goals were coincident. Maybe not the military goals or the political goals, but the general goals of intervention, of just achieving a permanent establishment of the U.S. in Cuba, I think were coincident, even if these operational differences were, of course, there. So,
Merci, c'est Cornelio Somaluga. Je voudrais revenir à l'exposé de Madame Ottaviani et la remercier de cette excellente présentation de Bartolo Di Grisoli. Au fond, je regrette de ne pas l'avoir su lorsque je l'ai su de l'Université de Bologne, l'honorable Université de Bologne, où lui était là aussi. Moi, j'ai reçu un doctorat honoris causa en médecine et chirurgie, ce qui n'était sans doute pas mérité pour moi, parce que c'était pour le CICR, mais j'ai dû faire un discours. Et si j'avais connu Di Grisoli, j'aurais eu beaucoup d'inspiration pour faire un discours qui faisait sens dans le sens de la Croix-Rouge. La question que je voulais vous poser, mon grand-père du côté maternel, Francesco Baragussa, était médecin-chef de la Croix-Rouge italienne pendant les deux dernières années de la Première Guerre mondiale. Il n'avait, je crois, pas d'expérience terrain. Mais pour finir, il était un des représentants italiens à la fameuse conférence de Cannes qui a lancé la Ligue des sociétés de Croix-Rouge. Et je voudrais savoir si le docteur Di Grisoli a été à Cannes à cette conférence, parce que sans doute il aurait pu amener beaucoup de l'expérience terrain qu'il avait eue.
Peut-être, oui, mais je n'ai pas sûr. Je sais qu'il est allé à Paris, où il parla des chirurgiens, de ses techniques, mais à Cannes, je n'ai pas. J'approfondirai.
Alors, je ne suis pas sûr pour Di Grisoli qui fut présent à Cannes, mais je pense qu'il avait des problèmes parce qu'il est un représentant de la gauche. Et je ne suis pas pour exemple, Palachano, c'est un représentant de la gauche et il ne peut parler jamais de Croix-Rouge en Italie. Okay? Il y a des problèmes sur les députés et sur les sénateurs italiens. Mais après, après, je vous dis que la conférence de Cannes est de 19 à la fin de la,
oui, à la fin de la guerre.
De la guerre. Dans 17, il y a Caporetto qui est la défaite de l'armée italienne.
Je voulais simplement dire, mon grand-père Francesco Baragussa n'était sans doute pas beaucoup de droite, ni vraiment de gauche. En tout cas, il était monarchiste. Alors, il était lié à l'ordre royal, il était le médecin des enfants du roi, des principes.
J'ai les actes de la conférence de 19. Je peux vous voir s'il est présent du Grisoli. Et après, j'ai téléécrit. OK? Merci.
D'autres questions?
My question is regarding the Spanish Red Cross in Cuba for Francisco. So I really like, I'm sorry I was a little late to the presentation, but I really like the idea of the horizontal relationship with the ARC and ICRC. And it made me wonder how much was this a result of the contingency, the historical contingency of the personality of Clara Barton, and how much this was a result of the entry of the U.S. into colonialism, or the ascendance of U.S. power. So how much, you know, it's a puzzle for me. I'm not sure, having looked at some of the archives. So I wonder what you think.
Well, I'm not sure, really. You know much more than me about Clara Barton. So I'm not a specialist in the... I understand that Clara Barton had long life links with the Geneva Committee due to his her stay in Europe and personal relation with Gustave Manier and others. So maybe it was after she was substitute in the Red Cross that this promotion of horizontal relations became more intense. So maybe she was in a way stopping that because of her personal relations with the Geneva Committee members. But I don't know. It might have been also a question of the very location of the conflicts. So they were much outside the usual geographical influence of the ICRC, which were of course more focused on Europe and its whereabouts than in the Caribbean or in the Far East. So maybe that geographical distance and historical distance could have promoted other kind of relations, such as with the, I don't know, with the British Red Cross, the Canadian branch of the British Red Cross, and I don't know, others. So I don't know exactly what to say, but this could be ideas.
Okay, thank you.
François Bignou, vous avez quelque chose à rajouter sur cette question? Le micro est derrière vous. Vous avez un micro derrière vous.
Thank you. My question also is directed at Mr. Francisco Javier Martinez. Would you say, or would you, in your assessment, that the dogmatic attitude of the ICRC at the time, reluctance to get involved in a situation of civil war as existed, or colonial war as existed in Cuba prior to the US intervention, or the question of assistance to civilians victims of the conflict, those reconcentrados, in fact favored this expansionist or international intervention oriented attitude of the American Red Cross, namely that the ICRC left the field vacant and the American Red Cross just occupied it. What would be your assessment?
Well, I'm not sure again what to ask. I think we could understand it as a difference of traditions. So the tradition of the American Red Cross was different from the tradition promoted by the ICRC, and the American Red Cross becomes in some years important enough or powerful enough so that the actions of the American Red Cross have a lot of consequences or a lot of influence. So I think the expression of this book of Julia Ewing is very appropriate, of this making international humanitarianism American. So they keep on wishing to have an international influence, but in an American way. And that's only because the American Red Cross becomes so important and so big after the World War I that it reaches that kind of influence. So the ICRC was, maybe it was beyond its reach to really have a strong influence. Apart that this, as Leonardo Zavala suggested, the ICRC or the Red Cross in Europe had been designed with they had a national design, so they always found difficult to intervene in this kind of conflicts, which were not clear what kind of conflict it was, or in any case it was an internal conflict, so there was always this and also with the thing of prisoners, which won't be taken as a Red Cross task until the Washington Conference in 1912. So there were like many new things that probably there was not a tradition of doing that. And the American Red Cross, on the other hand, was eager to do that. So
thank you very much. Merci beaucoup. Je vous propose de poursuivre la conversation autour d'un café, d'un thé qui sera préparé à l'étage et arrivé à 11h20 minutes. On va essayer d'être ponctuel. Et encore merci à nos conférenciers de ce matin.